The city has always been a communication space. That's one of the defining characteristics of cities, bringing together lots of diverse people. It's why it is a dynamic space for cultural invention. But it's becoming a communication space in a different sense in the present. More and more we see what I call user-generated content. Content that is made by non-professional people. The photo that you take on your phone when you're out with your friends and you upload to a blog or a website like Flickr or one of the photo sharing websites. All kinds of commentary, remixing of videos, citizen journalism, all these forms of media production in the present that are growing very rapidly. And a lot of it doesn't conform to the old model of media. The old model was very much like a pyramid with a hierarchy. So if you wanted to write for a newspaper, there was various editorial functions to filter what would be said. This was about quality control to some extent. The new model of user-generated content is much less like this, not a pyramid, much flatter, horizontal. People talk about it as viral because it depends upon someone getting an email and forwarding it to someone else. Someone seeing an image on the internet, downloading it, editing it, and passing it on to someone else. So a lot of content is now being produced by non-professional producers. I think the second aspect that's really significant is this idea of real-time person-to-person communication. By real-time, I mean near instantaneous. Okay, you take it when I'm coming today to the university, my taxi driver's lost, so I can take out my phone, ring Brandy and say, can you speak to the driver and tell him where to go. This kind of capability used to be, even 30 years ago, restricted to very special situations. Police, military, people who needed to communicate with each other had the technology. Now everybody, or nearly everybody, has the technology to do this. And this has a big impact on social life. We have a lot of studies now which say when people go out to meet friends, they no longer make a firm time and place. They just say, okay, we'll meet, I'll ring you and let you know where I am. And they negotiate it between them where they'll meet. So it changes the idea of punctuality and of planning. But we can also see the way in which large-scale, not just personal interactions, but large-scale interactions start to change, including public protests. We can talk about this from a cybernetic paradigm as feedback, but the feedback is not just coming from one place, but from many places. So we talk about this as recursive communication, which is simply that there's many different people all sending messages, and because these operate instantaneously, they can modify events as they go on. If you're attending a sporting event, you can organize to do something in the context of that event even while it's happening. These were not possible situations in the past. The third heading I've called ambient intelligence. And this is simply saying, actually, a lot of the way in which data is generated in cities now is not controlled by an individual user. There's all kinds of cameras, sensors, that gather information that is embedded in cities. Sensors telling about lighting conditions or temperature. Cameras that are looking at traffic conditions or cameras that are there for security purposes. In cities all around the world, there is large amounts of data being generated simply by day-to-day routine movement. And increasingly we see buildings becoming smart. That means the building can become responsive to you. It can learn something about your habits, your preferences, that you come into this building, you want the lights turned down a bit. It can do this automatically. A building can build a profile about its users. We see objects, consumer goods, being tagged with digital information. People might not be familiar with the expression RFID codes, radio frequency identification codes. They're a little bit like barcodes, but much more information is available on them. Increasingly, objects can communicate with other objects. If you order a book online, not only can you track it now, if it's been posted to you from another country, but the book itself can communicate to the store about where it is. Okay, so all of these things taken together, spread of media, ubiquity, real-time interactivity, the fact that most people are now media producers. We are all carrying mobile phones with cameras, with video. This creates a very different context for social life. Bill Mitchell talks about this as Hertzian space. Bill Mitchell, the recently deceased professor at MIT University. Hertzian space, he names this after the German physicist Heinrich Hertz, who was the first person to demonstrate, in a practical sense, the theory of electromagnetic waves. So he's simply saying Hertzian space means space in which interactions often take place electromagnetically, using internet, using radio, using digital media of various kinds. The urban theorist Anthony Townsend talks about the real-time city, the city in which action and response in very complicated patterns becomes an ordinary state of existence. Not something that's extraordinary, not something that you have to set up special systems for, but something that is just simply all around us. So I wanted then to talk about these new tendencies of public space, and I'm focusing on three broad tendencies. The first is this idea of spectacle, spectacular space. The second is the rise of surveillance. And the third I put in inverted commas because I don't think it's developed much yet, but the idea of participation or participatory space. So I'll talk about these each in turn. So for a long time, at least since the 1960s, in the West, people have analysed the tendency towards spectacle in public space, particularly working from the French Marxist Guy Debord, his book Society of the Spectacle. Debord talks about spectacle. It's not simply about that there's more images in society. He's saying it's a situation where social relationships are increasingly mediated by images. So you'd think on the one hand, yes, of a streetscape where there's lots of advertising. But he's also talking about the extent to which people start to internalize models of behavior based around things that they see in media culture. The key issue for Debord is that spectacle is a passive form of relationship, of social relationship. It's a very narrow mode of existence. So what he's saying there is that instead of shaping the social spaces that we live in, in a spectacular society, we're really just shaped by those spaces. We don't have agency, we don't have power to appropriate those spaces, to change them, to develop a genuine sense of belonging to them. Now, I could say a lot more about this, but I think in the interests of time, I'll move on. For De Boer, spectacle, the passivity of spectacle, is the other side of commodity culture. It's a condition that is brought about by the definition of social life in terms of material wealth, of commodities, and so on. The second issue is the issue of surveillance. Cities have always had surveillance in them. This isn't new. But what's very different now is the way that it's done. So you think of the old style city with a wall around it, watchtowers, gates, so that you knew who went in, who could get out, you could keep people out of it. Optical surveillance, yeah? You had to see them. This has been changing for a long time. If we go back to the invention of modern media, like photography, you think of in the Paris Commune in 1871, the communards stood on the barricades and they were photographed. And then later the police used those photographs to track down the people who were resisting, to hunt them down. In the 1980s, I lived in London in 1981, and it was very strange to see closed-circuit television cameras starting to appear all around the city. This was the height of an IRA bombing campaign, the Irish Republican Army, and they started to put in place the so-called Ring of Steel, cameras at banks, at railway stations, and so on. Today, this wouldn't be strange because most cities in the world have this infrastructure. There's cameras in many, many places. London is still probably the most heavily surveilled city in the world. I think in central London, there's over 10,000 closed-circuit television cameras. But cameras are only a little bit of how surveillance takes place today. All kinds of other everyday transactions, everyday actions that we do, also enable our movements to be identified. If we use an electronic credit card, if we use a mobile phone, if we do an internet search, all of those things can provide information about where you are. Not only just what you're looking at, but where you actually are. If you enter a building that requires swipe card access, if you use an automatic teller machine, if you travel down a freeway that has an electronic tolling system, like one in the city in which I live, in Melbourne. The Canadian sociologist David Lyon says that the key thing about digital surveillance compared to older forms of surveillance is not only that it's so cheap and easy, they're important aspects, but it's that it starts to integrate all kinds of streams of data. So 20 years ago, if a bank had a closed-circuit television camera, it probably fed it to a video recorder that was located in that bank. If you wanted to see the tapes, you'd have to go there and you'd have to look at them, you'd have to wind them through, and etc. Increasingly, as surveillance becomes digital, these standalone little islands of surveillance become oceans of surveillance, spreading out right across the city. And Lyon uses the example of one of the organizers of the attacks on the World Trade Center in the United States, Mohammed Atta. And he said, after those attacks, September 11, 2001, it was very quick for the authorities in the United States to be able to pull up a whole lot of video images of this person, not because he'd done anything extraordinary, but just through looking through surveillance logs at service stations, convenience stores, you know, where he'd bought petrol or bought some food or something like that. Within days, they could have video records of what he'd been doing over the last few days before the attacks. Lots of surveillance is not done by governments. Increasingly, it's done by corporations. When you use a popular social networking service like Facebook, which now has maybe 800 million users, every one of those users is providing detailed information about themselves, about their links to other people, about what they like. They can keep it, to some extent, private from other users. But Facebook, the corporation, has access to all that data. So increasingly, in a digital society, users voluntarily provide the material that companies or governments scrutinize. So these tendencies towards growing surveillance makes someone like David Lyon say, the old condition that I was talking about, living among strangers in the city, where there's people around you that you don't know, is starting to disappear because the surveillance identifies everybody. The French architectural theorist Paul Virilio talks about this context of the digital city as an overexposed city, no space of privacy left. The French philosopher Gilles Deleuze talks about it as control space. They're both very pessimistic views of what digital culture is producing, but we can understand and see the kinds of issues that they are talking about. From these first two headings, spectacle, surveillance, you can see that there's a lot of concern about what life will be like in these media cities, what kinds of social interactions will take place, where will there be a space of privacy? Is that important? How will ordinary people have some level of control over their own lived environments? One of the issues that interests me, coming from Australia, which is a society with a lot of immigrants and so a very diverse population mixing together of many different people, like Canada, like the United States, how will we respond to this cultural diversity in cities? And I think also a big issue for all cities is with the globalization of culture. How do we relate to global exchanges of information? I was talking earlier and saying one of the distinctive tendencies of digital media, of network culture, is the possibility for user-generated content. That it's not pyramid, top-down, but bottom-up. Lots of people making lots of different ideas, images, software. The idea of many-to-many communication. How will this play out in urban space? Can we use urban communication to allow greater forms of participation in public space. The sociologist Saskia Sassen, who wrote the very famous book The Global City about 20 years ago, has recently written an essay where she talks about the way that digital networks might support what she calls open source urbanism. Here she's referring to the way in which models of non-profit cooperation have been used in software development. Are people familiar with this idea of free open source, where people often work in their spare time collectively to develop certain kinds of software products that are not for commercial sale, but they're simply things that people think are useful or helpful? And this has become a very, very big part of the software industry, and you've seen a maturing of the kinds of development of open source up to the point where the Linux operating system is now a viable competitor to Microsoft's Windows and Apple's operating system. The open source model has spread beyond software to all kinds of areas of cultural production, and I think it's a very important model for cultural industries generally. New forms of collaboration in gaming, for instance. If you're playing online multiplayer games, a lot of the content of the game comes from the player. It's not built by the company. The company builds a platform, but the player defines what's happening there. Blogs, journalism, a lot of the content is developed collaboratively by users. So Saskia Sassen, she's talking mostly about how governments, local governments particularly, might provide better services to citizens, how they might be more responsive about issues to do with, you know, fixing the streets or making better public spaces or providing better libraries or whatever. But I think we can broaden the concept.